This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Looking to start a side hustle or become your own boss? Do it with Shopify. Whether you're selling succulents or stilettos, Shopify has the industry-leading tools to help you create, control, and grow your own business. So get serious about selling and get Shopify today. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.co.uk/special offer.
Hey folks, this is Kevin. This is an unusual episode you're about to hear. In 2021, our team here at Risk began to create a different podcast series, a series we called Real. Over the years, we'd noticed that some people out there are hesitant to listen to Risk for fear that an episode might contain something violent or sexual or just dark or bizarre. So we figured, what if we created a series that's safe to listen to even if your kids are within earshot? The 5 episodes of Real that we completed in 2021 consist of stories that were originally shared on Risk, but with the curse words or anything else too risky removed. You'll also notice all the music on the show was created by our own John LaSala. And the controlling idea of the Real podcast is that listening to stories and sharing stories is good for your mental health. In 2021, we were all really feeling the need for a lot of healthy self-care. So we had hoped the Real podcast would speak to people in that way. Now, for various reasons, we stopped making episodes of the Real podcast after we'd completed 5 episodes, and we never debuted it. But seeing as how Thursdays we rerun old material anyway, here's something old and new. We're going to run all 5 episodes of Real here in the feed before this year's over, and we'd love to hear your reaction to these episodes. So, without further ado, here's the 2nd episode of Real, and it's one we call Real Connections.
You're on the brink of bankruptcy, and you may not be the biological father of your children.
And she cuts me off. She says, "Honey, what's wrong?
This can't be real."
Oh, it's real.
It's real.
It felt real.
Are you for real?
I don't even know what real is.
Real. A real dog sound.
Real life.
Are you for real?
The real deal.
Real.
Man.
This is real.
This is Real. I'm Kevin Allison, and this is the podcast of true stories for everyone. You know, I don't know about you, but I had a rough 2020. I went through some spells of depression even. But recently, I was walking through Brooklyn, listening to Christine Gentry telling this first story we're about to hear on the podcast today. It's a story about a time in Christine's life when she thought, you know what? Here's a possibility. I'm going to do something I never imagined I'd do. And I remember stopping on the sidewalk and saying to myself, that way of thinking is the opposite of depression. Then I thought, well, yeah, some of my favorite stories of my own are about times I said, let's experiment. Times I was thinking in terms of possibilities that sparked potential and became great stories, like this one by Christine Gentry. She's a writer and a teacher in New York, and here she is now with a story we call Making the Chain.
So it's 2012, and I'm scrolling through Facebook, and in between, cat videos and Foursquare check-ins, because it's 2012. I see a post from an old friend of mine. Actually, I hadn't seen her in years. We were really close my first year of teaching. And the post was, I'm dying. It was like, I'm dying. My kidneys are completely giving up on me. All of my friends and family have already tried to donate a kidney to me, and this is my last resort. So Facebook, is somebody willing to donate a kidney to me? And I dropped everything and sent her a message. I was like, I am so sorry. I didn't even know you were sick. We haven't spoken in a while, but like absolutely, you know, what do I need to do? And thus began this really intense series of tests. So I don't know if you guys know, but it's incredibly difficult to be approved to donate a kidney, which is why all of her friends and family had been rejected. So they run every test you can possibly run on a human being, including a pretty intense psychological exam. And if they find one thing wrong with you, they say no. But I was very lucky, and I got approved to donate. But Julia and I, as a couple, were not as lucky because I could not directly give my kidney to her. We were not a direct match. So it's way more complicated than I have time to explain to you. But like, you have to be blood type, tissue type, antigen, and a bunch of other stuff, right? So I couldn't directly give my kidney to Julia. But we were approved to go into this really cool system called the National Kidney Swap Registry. So it's this algorithm, this amazing computer that tries to take all of the incompatible donor recipient pairs across the country and figure out if I can give my kidney to some random person in the country that I'm a match to, and then further down this swap chain, Julia will get one, right? So we go into the system and the computer gets to work and it's trying to figure out how to make a chain. And at the very last minute, Julia directly matches with someone else and my kidney is not needed. Guys, it was amazing to watch the transformation of my friend Julia, right? She was not being hyperbolic on Facebook, right? She was attached to dialysis, which is basically the machine from Princess Bride, you know? Like, she was going home every day and hooking herself up and being like, please don't go to 50. Like, that was her day. And this one surgery, just every time I saw her, she was like a new and happier person. And then last year, she got pregnant. She had a baby. And I was looking at this child, and I was like, oh my God, like this new life and every life that will be touched by it only exists because someone was willing to donate their kidney, and I just couldn't justify not doing it for a stranger. So I called the same organization, and I said, this time I want to donate my kidney to anyone. I want to be what you guys call a good Samaritan donor. And it had been long enough to where they made me go through all the testing again. But again, I was very lucky. I got approved, and this time it moved very quickly. I mean, within 2 weeks of my testing, the surgery date was set, and the computer was loving it because this time I didn't go in with any conditions, right? Last time I went in with a very complicated condition, which was Julia, right? Julia has to receive one. And this time I'm like, I'll give it to anybody. Kidney for you. And the computer was like, awesome. And it got to work. And it figured out the longest possible chain, right? It was like, oh my God, she can give her kidney to this person who's been waiting. And their incompatible donor can give their kidney to this person. And their incompatible donor can give their kidney to this person. And so when the surgery date was set, there was already a chain of 16 surgeries that my donation was going to set off, right? So I was going to pull 8 people off of that monstrous, horrible wait list. Like, what an honor. And I struggled with how to kind of deal with the celerity. It was moving so quickly. And I thought, you know, like, I don't want to be misunderstood. I don't want people to think that this is really weird, that I'm some kind of like hero or saint. So I chose to keep it very private. And I told very few people, but I did have to choose a caretaker. So I definitely had to ask someone to take care of me. You can't do anything basically for the first week. And my mother is a nurse. Seems pretty obvious that you would ask your mom, the nurse. But it was a very complicated decision for me because my relationship with my mother the last couple years has been very strained. She was this glowing, like beautiful presence when I was a child, and this drinking problem had entered into her life and just sucked her into this really horrible place. Like, physically she was unwell. She looked 20 years older than she should have looked. She was getting like slurring drunk like every night, and And with it came this horrible cloud of negativity. I remember she came to visit me when I was living in New York. It was basically like a jump from alcoholic serving establishment to alcoholic serving establishment. And if they were more than two blocks away from each other, she would complain. And we would go down into the subway and she would turn her tiny engagement ring around and say, "I hear that they take your jewelry on the subway." And I was like, "Who are you? Who are you? You don't even resemble the mother that I knew when I was a child." And so, like, when I had to choose this caretaker, I was thinking, like, first of all, there's a very real risk that this woman can't stay sober, honestly, for a week to take care of me. And also, like, that kind of negativity is not something I need around me when I'm going through this major recovery. And so I wrestled with it for a couple of days, but then I finally decided to ask her. So I invited her to come up, and she could only take exactly, you know, X number of days off. So she was going to come in the night before my surgery. And as the surgery approached, I was getting overcome with this level of like fear and anxiety that I'd never known before and didn't really know how to deal with. Like the most extreme medical thing I'd ever been through was having my wisdom teeth removed, you know? Like, I had no idea what to expect. I had read all the things, but I had no idea what to expect as far as the actual experience. And I remember the Friday before this surgery came, like, it was now less than a week away, and I almost, like, I think I was having a panic attack. I don't know. I was, my palms were sweaty. I was very lightheaded. I was so afraid. I couldn't stop focusing, like, laser focus on all of the things that I'd read, you know? Like, what if I die on this operating table? What if I get an infection? What if my kidney dies on the runway trying to get to this person that I'm trying to help? What if one day my other kidney fails? What if someone I really love needs one and I've already given it up to, like, Joe Schmo, you know? Like, all of these thoughts just were swirling around and I had no one to share them with or talk to, so I was, like, kind of a mess, and I started frantically cleaning my apartment, and I found this bag of clothes that I had shoved into the corner probably years ago that needed to be, like, tailored and repaired, and I was like, perfect, perfect distraction. So I go on Yelp, and I'm, like, searching for the closest tailor, and sure enough, there was someone who worked right out of her apartment, literally down the street from mine, and her name was Brunhilda, and I was like, yes. That Brunhilda, that's exactly what I need. And I give her a call, and of course she's available. The thick German accent when she answers the phone. I was like, this is perfect. This is meant to be. And so I start walking down the street to Brunhilda's apartment, and it's February, it's Boston, it's snowing, I'm crying, it's all very emo. And I have my bag of clothes, and I get to Brunhilda's apartment, and she opens the door, and she looks exactly the way that you think she looks. Like, giant German woman, huge boobs. And I walk in, and I open the bag of clothes, and I start pulling them out to kind of explain to her the things that I needed done to them. And she cuts me off. She says, "Honey, what's wrong?" And my bottom lip starts quivering, and I said, "Oh, Brunhilda, I'm donating a kidney on Thursday, and I'm so scared." And she just grabs me. She gives me this big old hug. She, like, sinks my head in the middle of her big boobs. She starts pawing my back. She goes, "Honey, you are doing a wonderful thing. You must remember to be one with the pain." It was just this, like, it was this beautiful moment of this absolute stranger giving me exactly the thing that I so needed in that moment. And so when I was walking home from Brunhilda's house, I was like, I have to tell people about this. I have to. I mean, first of all, the only reason I even know that it's an option is because someone posted on Facebook. But also, like, I'm not okay. I'm not okay right now. And I need to own that, and I need to reach out to my support network. And of course, like, as soon as I posted about it, there's this outpouring of love and support. It just so bolstered me. And, like, Brunhilda and I decided that I would pick up my clothes the night before the surgery on purpose. And so I go to her apartment, you know, the night before, and she opens the door, and this time she goes, "Honey, you look good. Last week, not so good. Now you look good." And my mom flew in, you know, after I picked up my clothes, and I immediately got worried because the first thing she wanted to do was go get a burger and a couple beers. And I was like, oh, God. And I, like, kept my worry to myself. I was like, maybe it's just night before jitters. Maybe she just got to get that, you know, last beer out of her system. And we came home from the restaurant, and we sat down on my bed, and our knees were touching, and she held my hands across our laps. And I'm not even a religious person, but she said this prayer over me. She was basically just asking God to protect me, and I just felt it. I just felt this sense of peace. And I told her about how nervous and scared that I had been, and like how I think it's difficult for anonymous donors because, you know, in 2012, it was so easy. Anytime I started to get afraid about this possibility, I would just look at Julia. I'd be like, oh, obviously, like, look at this person that I care about, like, suffering. And this time, you know, there's no palpable thing. There's no person to look at. I'm, like, sending my kidney out into the ether, you know? Like, or in my case, Ohio. And it's hard, you know? So I was, like, telling her. I was crying. I was explaining, you know, the panic attack and Brunhilde and how amazing she is. And my mom helped me come up. She was like, you need to give these people faces. You know, these eight people, these eight recipients that you're pulling off of the wait list, like, you need to imagine what they look like. And so we came up together with this haven. You know, it was based on this plaza in Barcelona that I just stumbled upon, and just, it was so beautiful. Like, I turned the corner and it opened up into this plaza with an old church, and there was this big tree, and it was like raining orange flowers, and there was this little turquoise water fountain bubbling in the middle of it, and I was the only person there, and it was just the sound of my heart and like classical guitar bouncing off of the labyrinth of the Gothic quarter. You know, it was just this magical place. And so we decided that was going to be my haven. And whenever I got scared, I would close my eyes and turn the corner, and I would be in that plaza, and I put the eight people at that fountain. And every time I got scared, I would just think about turning the corner and seeing those eight and being like, right, this is why I'm doing it. And I rolled into that operating room the next day, having never been more sure of anything in my life. Such a sense of calm and peace had come over me. But I am not here to lie to you. And the first few days of recovery were awful. They were so hard. And my mother got the crap shift. She did. And she did not leave my side. She slept in the hospital room with me. She didn't have a drop of alcohol or utter one complaint for 5 days. And the third day that I was in the hospital, they took me off of the Dilaudid IV drip and they tried to replace it with an oral version of the pill. And my stomach was not taking it. And you guys, like, nausea is just a terrible feeling regardless. Like, you all know it. It's awful. It's objectively a terrible feeling. But when nausea is bathed in terror because you've just had major surgery and you have this giant abdominal incision and you know that if you puke, it's going to hurt so badly. Like, that was the feeling that I had. And my mother was comforting me. And then I puked. Valentine's Day. It was Valentine's Day, day three. And I was incapacitated, and so I just puked all over myself. And so there was, like, the embarrassment, and I'm crying, and the pain. Guys, the pain, it was like every time I heaved, it was like a blacksmith had taken a newly forged spear and shoved it into my side. And my mother took this warm washcloth, and she was wiping my face. And I grabbed the bars of that hospital bed, crying, and I said, I don't want to regret this, Mama. I really don't want to regret this. She was wiping my face, saying, you won't, Christine. It'll get so much better. And the nurse came in, and she was like, oh, we should probably try a different pill. And I grabbed her scrubs, and I was like, you will never put another prescription pain medicine in my mouth. And she goes, it's really early. And I was like, I don't care. So that's how on day three of my surgery, I started recovery on just over-the-counter Tylenol. And it was my mother who pushed me to get out of bed every day, even though it hurt so badly. She said, you can walk a little further this time. I saw you touch the edge of that windowsill yesterday. I bet you can make it to the other side of that window today. And when they finally took my catheter out and I was so excited about taking a shower and then got so crushed because I couldn't do it myself, it was my mom who took me and led me from the bed, and she walked me to the shower and she put the seat down in it and she took my clothes off and she sat me down in the shower and then she took her clothes off. And she stepped into the shower and she closed the curtain and she bathed me so gently and we were both crying and she said, Christine, it's just like when you were a baby. I went home on day 4 and my mom and my best friend took care of me for another 6 days and my friends brought me more food than I can even eat and my students made me homemade cards. And then I got a call from the National Kidney Registry about a month ago. And they said, Christine, the chain that you started is still going. It's 56 surgeries long. Your one decision has pulled 28 people off of the wait list. What an honor. That's more people than could ever fit around that fountain. And they said, we want you to come to our gala. It's the longest chain we've had in years. We want you to speak. And I said, absolutely. As long as I can bring my mom. Thank you.
Christine's donation led to a lot of things. She met the woman whose life was saved by her kidney, a wife and a mother. And Christine went on to mentor a lot of other folks through the process of donating their kidneys. But she also wrote her doctoral dissertation on storytelling, so I asked her what that was like.
There was this time in my dissertation work that a 16-year-old girl in East New York, Brooklyn, said something that just totally blew my mind. She was like, you know, miss, the painful things that happen in our lives are the things that we tend to have the most emotions about, you know? And those emotions get tangled and jumbled and confused and twisted, and they're kind of like vines, you know? And they get tangled up and they just freeze. And when we take that painful thing and we tell a story about it, it's like untangling those vines and laying them out so that not only does it make more sense to the person you're telling it to, but it also makes more sense to you. And I was like, oh my God, you just blew my mind. Like there's no way I'm gonna come up with something better than that. And the stories that we tell ourselves and the stories that we tell others are the way that we define who we are. You know, what are we if not a collection of our stories? And we're constantly making choices about which stories we're gonna tell and how we're gonna tell them. And that is the process of identity construction, you know? Like, and we don't have just one identity. We have multiple identities and we're constantly navigating them. And the way that we do that is through narrative. It's through stories.
We'll be back in a bit after this short break.
AI might be the most important innovation ever. It's storming every industry with literally billions being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs the right data and a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? Time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, and application development with AI embedded across it all. And Oracle Sovereign Cloud helps you address your requirements for location, access, and data residency. OCI provides blazing fast speeds for AI's demanding workloads. And in the cloud, when you pay by the minute, speed matters. And of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. If you want OCI to help you do more and spend less, like Uber, the Premier League and Oracle Red Bull Racing, take a free test drive at oracle.com/bandwidth. That's oracle.com/bandwidth. oracle.com/bandwidth.
And we're back. A couple months ago, I was texting back and forth with this fella on a dating app. We were, you know, getting to know the basics about each other. And finally, I suggested we take a walk in the park. But then there was no reply for like over a week. And I thought, oh, he must have decided I'm weird or maybe not wealthy enough or something. You know, those negative stories that run through your head. And finally, I just texted him to say, I get the feeling something just wasn't clicking for you. And he wrote back, well, I haven't told you, but I have a handicap and I can't walk. So when you suggested a walk in the park, I just panicked. Well, that possibility had not occurred to me, and it didn't matter to me. So sometimes the possibilities that open up for us come from things we hadn't considered what was going on in the lives of others. And a perfect example of that is our next story by Ernest Anfin, who made it through some dark times to share with us this beautiful story that we call Marilyn.
So we're going to go back to a sub-zero day in January of 2003. I was meeting with my divorce attorney in the Thrivent cafeteria in downtown Minneapolis. We were getting together to talk about the results of her investigation. She was investigating the activities of my soon-to-be ex-wife. We sat down, and of course, initially, the conversation was light and casual, but shortly thereafter, she put down her fork, she quit eating her salad, and she looked at me with tears welling up in her eyes, and she said, there's just no easy way to tell you this. You're on the brink of bankruptcy, and you may not be the biological father of your children. My family was destroyed by deception and infidelity. And I found out at the Thrivent cafeteria. My ex, unbeknownst to me, had run up tens of thousands of dollars in credit card debt using my forged signature and a secret P.O. box. The interest alone on this debt every month was around $4,000. And that was the good news. The bad news was that she had had an affair throughout our entire marriage, one that predated our marriage, in fact, predated the conception of our children by several years. And until I was sitting there in that cafeteria, I knew nothing about this man, this stranger, who was so intertwined in my life. All I knew was that he was 20 or 30 years older than me, but as my lawyer said, he might be the father of my children. My children, two of them. August was about four at the time. He was this blonde-haired, big-boned boy that looked like he could crush any of his friends. But if the other boys were roughhousing, August was more likely to be off in a corner painting a picture or singing a song, lost in his own world. His favorite thing to do every night was to grab a book and crawl in my lap. And we would read that book until its last page, and then he would flip them all over and say, again. And we would read that book over and over and over again until he fell asleep in my arms. My daughter, Ava, was about a year old at the time, a year and a half. Even at that age, she was very mischievous, and she continues to be very mischievous. She, if you need a visual reference, think of Boo from Monsters, Inc. At that point in her life, that was the way, shape, and form of Ava. Like Boo, she had a tender side as well. I remember one day the kids were playing in the toy closet. It was this big closet like the size of a room. And I was in the corner just crying. And I was sitting there watching the kids. They were playing with their action figures. They were jabbering back and forth with each other. And I was watching this ballet of sorts. And I couldn't wrap my head around the idea that perhaps these two beautiful creatures, the most beautiful things that I thought I could ever create in my life, were a lie. I knew my marriage was a lie, but what if this was a lie too? What if I had nothing to do with them being on this planet? Ava noticed me crying, and she crawled across the floor and into my lap and buried her head in my chest and wrapped her arms around me, squeezing as tightly as her little body could squeeze me, all the while just gingerly patting me on the back. It was amazing. I mean, this little girl who couldn't even talk yet was trying to take my pain away, was trying to squeeze the pain out of me, a pain that could not be taken away. I knew then that, of course, the biology didn't matter. I loved her. I loved August. I had to stay and fight for this love. The only way this love could be lost is if I lost it, if I destroyed it. But the fight wasn't easy. I still to this day don't understand. She wouldn't agree to joint custody, would not agree to it. And to this day, she still, we get along fine, but amazingly. But we've been divorced for 18 years, so it takes as much energy to hate as it takes to love, and I have tried to neither hate nor love her. Obviously, the love part isn't the issue, but the hate part, you got to let that go. The divorce process was against me. She was the primary caregiver. Regardless of everything she did, she was the stay-at-home mom. I was the big firm lawyer with a crazy work schedule. And let me tell you something, the court really doesn't give a shit about you and your kids if you're going through a divorce. The court system wants to take the easy path. And the easy path in our situation was to award custody to my ex and hope that I went away. But even when things seemed to be going well, when I felt I was making some progress and the presumption of the primary caregiver was dwindling, she had another club that she would use against me whenever she had the opportunity, and that club was depression. I came from a long line of depressed people, and my personal depression was compounded by the golden boy status I had growing up in a small town in Iowa. I felt like the world's eyes were always upon me. I felt like I had to be the perfect athlete, the perfect student, the perfect person. And even though I'd been in therapy and on medication for years, my ex knew how much I was tormented by failure, or the perception of failure would be magnified in my mind 100 times, 1,000 times. And here I was failing at the biggest thing in life, failing as a father, failing as a husband. The system had no problem picking up that club and helping her hit me with it. With that club, I was not only the non-primary caregiver, I was also not fit because I was depressed. And it wasn't just the system and my ex. Everywhere I went, it felt like people criticized me. I would go to Target after work to get groceries, and I'd have my kids with me, just like any mom. But people weren't used to seeing a man alone with a kid back then in the early 2000s. And if my kids acted up at all, inevitably some old person would come up to me and say, "Well, Dad, that wasn't such a good idea now, was it? Coming shopping without the wife." And then they'd laugh and walk away. And those comments happen far more often than you can imagine, unless you're another divorced father. But the shopping critics weren't the worst. The worst was at church. I grew up in a family where I was told that if you're in pain, if you're in need of support, go to church. And I was in pain, and I needed support, so I went to church. But it didn't matter what church we went to. And again, I don't think these people were wanting to harm me, but after the service, some older person would come and say, "Hey, Dad, where's the wife? Is she at work today?" Or they'd ask my kids, "Where's Mom?" And again, I don't think they meant anything by these questions, consciously, but in my mind, they cut like a knife to my bone. I mean, To me, they sought assurance that I belonged there, my kids belonged there. We were a Christian family. There was a wife, there was a mom. She just wasn't there that day, but she's around, certainly. We're not some misfits that wandered in off the street. And all of the negativity and criticism that I was feeling at that time seemed to be embodied in this old woman who would sit in the lobby of my post-divorce apartment building day after day, in the lounge chairs next to the mailboxes. She was a very small woman, fragile, probably about 80. She had this dark-dyed hair and this white skin, eyebrows painted on her forehead, these half-lens reading glasses that were always perched on the tip of her nose and a chain around her neck. And she saw everything that I went through day after day after day. She saw all of my struggles, all my failures, because she was always there. She saw me the day that Ava thought it would be hilarious to poop in the pool, which was right next to the lobby. And I was frantically swimming around in the pool trying to pick up the little poop things because they were either going to disintegrate or they were going to go in the filter system of the pool. And I felt like a bad dad that day, but it happens, right? She was there the day that Ava threw my keys down the elevator shaft and we had to get maintenance to fish them out. And you know, it's not like these things happen and you're all happy with, oh, that's so cute. Years from now, well, I was mad, you know? I was mad. And she saw me mad and she saw me lose it. And she was just always there. She never said anything. She never did anything. She just stared at us. And she was there the day that I opened my mailbox and there were two envelopes in that mailbox from the Memorial Blood Center. If you don't know what the Memorial Blood Center is, it's a good thing because that's where Hennepin County sends you if there's a paternity issue and you need your blood tested. So those two envelopes were going to tell me once and for all whether I was the biological father of my children. You know, it wasn't Jerry Springer. There was no drama, no drum roll, nothing like that. I open the envelopes and it's just two charts with just numbers and numbers. And I'm frantically searching the charts trying to figure out what do they say. And at the bottom I see words finally. And it says percentile probability of paternity. And next to those words were the numbers 99 point whatever, whatever, whatever percentage. At that moment, a huge weight was lifted from my shoulders. It was news that I had waited months to hear. It meant that I was the father of both of my kids, and I fell into those lounge chairs and I cried immediately, uncontrollably. And through those tears, I kept searching that form, those charts, to make sure I was seeing what I thought I was seeing. And when I came to my senses, I looked up, and there sitting across the table from me was the old lobby lady. With her eyebrows painted on her forehead and her black eyes staring at me and her brow furrowed. She didn't need to say anything. She was telling me everything I needed to know with her expression. She was saying, young man, I don't know what the hell this emotional outburst is all about, but not in my lobby. Not here, not now, not ever. She said nothing, offered nothing, asked nothing. I just knew it was time to leave. So I gathered up my charts and my envelopes, and I quietly went back to my apartment. And all of this judgment, criticism, negativity led my depression into a very dark place. Many nights when I went to bed, I felt as if there was a demon lying next to me, and the demon did not speak. The demon hissed. I mean, it hissed. And it told me the same things over and over, minute after minute. You're no man. You're no husband. Your wife cheated on you with an old guy. You couldn't even compete with an old man. What kind of a man are you? Oh, and your kids, yeah, they love you. Your kids are infants, which means they're idiots. They don't know you. They just love you because they don't have a choice. When they grow up and they figure out what kind of a f*** you are, they'll hate you because you will probably f*** them up over the next decade or so as well. The world's right. We'd be better off without you. Your ex, the courts, they're all right. Just go away. And minute after minute, I would lie there and just want to go away, to escape that demon. And At the foot of my bed, there was a patio door, a sliding patio door that led to the ninth floor balcony of my apartment. And beyond that balcony, there was this beautiful meadow of light. It was the lights of Edina just spread out beneath that balcony like little flowers blossoming on this very, very dark hillside. And I knew that all I had to do was walk across my bedroom, slide that door open, and lean over that rail and fall into that bed of light. Fall into that meadow of light and sleep forever. That sleep would quiet these voices. That sleep would make the demon go away. That sleep would leave me in peace, finally. I just wanted the struggle to end. I felt like I was Job from the Bible. I felt God had long, long ago abandoned me. And the most that I could pray for was for God's wrath to pass over me, for the night to end, for the demon to quit hissing, for the meadow of light to disappear, for this struggle to just stop. And minute after minute, it was a fight with that door. And the worst fight of all was that I didn't know what the future held. One day was a particularly bad day. We went to court to receive the custody evaluator's recommendation. And if you've been in a divorce, you also know that nothing can happen, as far as custody is concerned, until your evaluator gives you a recommendation. Ina had been to court. Well, Ina was the custody evaluator. She had been to court many, many times, and every time she'd go to court, she'd get up and she'd say to the judge, "Oh, Your Honor, I'm so sorry. I am not ready. I need more time. I have a lot of cases, and this man, this father, is being very difficult. You know, he doesn't understand the whole primary caregiving thing, and he's depressed. And I've got lots of cases." And every day, the judge would give her a continuance, every day that we were supposed to get that report. That day, she left the court, and she saw how frustrated I was, and she walked up to me, and she said, "You've got to come to an agreement with your wife. You're going to lose your kids." And I said, "Ina, I'm never going to voluntarily give up my kids." She said, "Well, if I file my report, you'll lose." And I said, "Ina, I am never going to make your job easy. If I'm going to lose my kids, you're going to have to take them away from me. File your report." And I turned around and walked away from her. There was nobody who cheered me at that point. Even after the trauma that day, you know, life didn't end. It was a Wednesday, so I had my kids that night, and I had no laundry. Laundry is always there. We all know that. So I took my kids, and I went down to the laundry room of my apartment building, and it was this incredibly bright room. Everything was white, and in the corner they had some plastic chairs and a little table and, you know, magazines and some kids' books. And I took the kids over to the corner and I left them there. And guess what? The old lobby lady is sitting there staring at me that day, saying nothing, asking nothing, offering nothing. And I just didn't have time or energy to deal with her. I never dealt with her, really. I dealt with her by ignoring her. And I just walked past her. I started to sort clothes. I was too preoccupied with the whole Ina situation. And I was sorting my clothes, and I was like, "My God, what have I done? That was the stupidest thing in the world." I mean, I felt like I'd signed the death warrant on my custody dispute. I thought I was forcing Ina's hand to pull the switch on that electric chair. I mean, what could I do? Could I apologize to her? How would I apologize? Well, should I? No, you did the right thing. You stood up to her. That was the right thing to do. And I was shaking, and I couldn't stop myself from shaking. It was like I had Parkinson's or something. And then all of a sudden, whack, "August!" And there was this scream from the corner. There was this clatter of plastic and ripped pages and skin being slapped. And I went to the corner, and I picked up Ava, and I grabbed August by the hand, and I dragged him back to the washing machine. And at that point, every molecule in my body was exploding. It was bursting. It felt like it was bursting out of every pore of my skin, and I was doing everything I could to just keep it together. But I was losing the battle. The membrane was breaking, and I was on the verge of tears. And then all of a sudden, I felt this hand on my shoulder, and I was startled, and I turned around, and it's the old lady from the lobby. I'm like, okay, let's go. You decide today. Today of all the days, you're going to come up to me and tell me I'm a dad. I've been waiting for this, lady. And today you picked the wrong day. I don't care if you're 80. I don't. I'm going to rip your head off. She looked at me with an expressionless face above her little reading glasses. And she said in the sweetest, kindest voice, she said, I don't know who you are, but you need to know you're a wonderful father. All of that energy that was traveling away from the center of my being at the speed of light just immediately reversed course and came imploding into my heart, and I fell into this 80-year-old woman. I fell into her body, and she wrapped her arms around me and squeezed me as tightly as an arthritic 80-year-old woman could squeeze me, and gingerly patted me on the back. And I said, who are you? She said, I'm Marilyn. Ava was still crying into my neck, still upset by the fight with her brother. I don't even think she noticed what was going on. August was standing next to me, his mouth agape. We had all been terrified of this woman for years, scared to death of her. And here she was being nice, not just nice, just genuinely wonderful. And I said, Marilyn, I can't tell you how much I needed to hear what you just told me. And she said, my dear, what's wrong? It can't be that bad. I whispered to her, I said, Marilyn, I'm fighting my ex for custody and I'm going to lose. She took me by the shoulders and pushed me back so that she could look at me in the eye. And she said, well, I don't know anything about any of that. But anybody who's ever seen the three of you together can see how much you love each other. You can never lose that. No one can ever take that away from you. I'm not sure what happened that day in the laundry room. But if God has ever been present in my life, he was present in that moment. Marilyn was God's voice. Marilyn was God's touch. Marilyn was God's face. Because of Marilyn, I knew God hadn't abandoned me. And after that night, I never again heard the hissing voice of that demon. I never again considered the peace promised by that meadow of light. Ina filed her report. And true to Ina's word, she recommended that my ex get custody. And I lost custody of my kids. I was relegated to being a weekend dad. But I was a dad. And I'm still a dad. August is now 20 years old and goes to college in Chicago. Ava is a senior in high school. And still, when she and I are together at night, we pray to God. And I kiss her on her forehead, and she tells me she loves me. Marilyn saved me not just that night, but she saved me so that I could experience a lifetime filled with dogs and cats. I don't know how many betta fish or hermit crabs, a snake. I was able to experience countless trips to the cabin, band concerts, and Dairy Queen blizzards. Because of her, I experienced for 18 years the joy, love, and fulfillment of fatherhood. One woman stood up and embraced me, held me close when it felt like the rest of the world was trying to push me away. One woman restored my belief in myself. My belief in myself as a father. One woman renewed my faith in love, my faith in the love of God. And Marilyn, I know you're probably not with us anymore, but I just want to say thank you.
I'll tell you, every time I hear that story, it's an experience. There's this wave of emotion that rolls through me. And Ernest shared with me about how stories can do that sort of thing.
What I love about storytelling is its ability to enable us to overcome the inherent limitations of language. So what do I mean by that? Any word doesn't really have meaning unless you provide context to the word. So, for example, if I say I want to go home, does that mean I want to go back to the place in which I currently live? Does that mean I want to go to my childhood home where I grew up? Does that even refer to a physical place? Maybe it's a place of emotional security or a person who gives me emotional security. Without context, the word home doesn't mean anything. And so when we're telling stories with word after word after word after word, we provide context to each word. And somehow, through that process, we are able to use language to transcend the meaning of language and express ideas and emotions that really can't be expressed through language. Ideas like joy and pain and love and hate and suffering and pleasure. And that's the craziest thing about storytelling. We use language to transcend the meaning of language. It's a very magical thing.
It's true. And when you hear lots of stories, like I do, on a regular basis, you know, stories about people who were closed down somehow, but then opened up somehow instead, it helps. It's one way that we show one another how we find new possibilities. Well, we are so grateful to you for showing up with your ears and your hearts today. If you found something of value in this episode, then sharing Real with your friends and family might just open up real possibilities in their lives. And there's more to come. Next time on the podcast, we'll hear from Donna Bailey and Deke Neighbors.
I did not in any way understand George, this little thing, to be anything other than just a baby. It was impossible for me to imagine what it would be like to have a personal relationship to him. He was, in fact, nothing but a bundle of needs, as I understood it.
Stories about saying hello and saying goodbye on the next episode of Real. Real is brought to you by the same folks who produced the podcast Risk. But that show sometimes includes stories that are not safe for work, as they say. Real is not a kid's show, but it's pretty safe to be playing if your kids are within earshot. That's why we say Real is true stories for everyone. So spread the word to everyone. On Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, we're at RealPodOfficial. And our website is realpodofficial.com. If you think you might like to give storytelling a try or learn about one of our customized corporate workshops, visit our school at thestorystudio.org. Special thanks on this episode to our storytellers, of course, and to our producer, composer, and audio editor, John LaSala. And once again, to you, remember, listen, share, and be real. Well, that is all for the second episode of Real that we call Real Connections. Let us know what you think. Were there some aspects you loved and some not as much? Should we have kept making this series? You can always leave comments on our website, on our subreddit, Risk Podcast, or at the Risk Podcast Fans Discussion Group on Facebook. And of course, I'm always at kevin@risk-show.com. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk.